Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Encanto and a couple of documentaries that are currently out there. Starting with Encanto, which is the word comes from Spanish and means charm, spell, or enchantment. It's both used as a way to tell a magic incantation and as an adjective for sweetheart. Now, this is set in Colombia, and it contains several nods and themes of magical realism to a literary genre using magical elements in ordinary settings, which sort of evokes the works of Colombian writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So if you've ever read 100 Years of Solitude, you're immediately going to go into this movie and feel right at home. So this is an animated feature, by the way. Mike, are you a fan of animated films?
The short answer is yes. The longer answer is it depends. Some yes, some no. But I'll go with the short answer of yes. One reason why animation works particularly well for the story is the magical realism that Marie referred to. You could do that in any film with special effects, et cetera. But you know, in animation, it's all special effects, if you will. You're making the world completely. And one of the nice things about this particular story is it is so colorful and so fluid, and it's just, you know, it's really a pleasure to watch it. You know, I don't want to go overboard and overpraise it, but it's an enjoyable film, you know, and thematically it works really well for any audience, but particularly for young audiences, because the gist of the storyline is that you have a family, and this family has a somewhat troubled history, and there's some grounding here in terms of, you know, the real world, if you will, namely that there's been some political violence. The family is uprooted. They're immigrants, if you will. They're moving through dangerous territory. What's going to help them find a place to live, salvation, if you will, is a magic candle. Now, usually when I talk about things like this, at some point, students or friends will ask me somehow to explain it. Well, how can I explain a magic candle? You know, it's a candle and it has magical powers. Leave it at that. But anyway, as they settle into their new home, it turns out, and there's the abuela, there's the matriarch, the garter, the guardian, if you will, of the candle. Keep that flame lit. And so what happens in the new home is you're going to have then children within the family, and they are all blessed with supernatural skills, except for one girl, one of the children. And at first, she feels like really left out, really lonely, and why doesn't she have magical powers? This is, after all, magical realism. All she has is realism. So thematically, why the story works well, I think, particularly for young viewers, is that the moral arc of it, if you will, is that she comes to realize that she has her own sense of self-worth. In other words, you know, that's something in its own way kind of magical. And I think any viewer can appreciate that, but particularly at a tender age, you know, kids watching an animated film, that's the storyline that will come across. And so any viewer can appreciate it. But what viewers will all enjoy, I think, simply is that the story is well-paced. It moves quickly. The characters are boisterous and just fun to be around. And at the level of magical realism, yes, you can distort shapes. You can change colors. You can do all sorts of things. And I don't oftentimes use the word eye candy in an approving way, but this is just a film that's like really easy on the eyes. It's just enjoyable to watch. So again, I'm not going overboard in terms of how many stars I would give it, but just simply saying, if you're looking for a good family-oriented animated film, Encanto really neatly fits the bill.
Yeah, and I want to underscore what you said about the colors. It is a riot of colors. Reminded me very much of Coco, not just the colors and the themes, but just the feel of the movie just reminded me very much of Coco, in that, you know, you sort of have this dealing with the unseen world as part of the plot. The three-dimensionality of the objects are absolutely fantastic. Occasionally, I teach a class in the history of animated film with Dave Hinton, and this would be one that we would definitely show in class to point out the things like, look at that ball of yarn. Doesn't that look three-dimensional? Look at the way they've handled the reflections. You know, isn't that really effective? Look how great the hair is rendered. In terms of the quality of the work that went into this, it is really excellent. It's the first Disney character that wears glasses. The glasses look very realistic in terms of the reflections and stuff. A lot of really delightful moments just in terms of the animation and the effects of things like fairy dust turning into butterflies. You know, again, that's a Marquez reference. That's a repeating motif in 100 Years of Solitude. So there's just lots of really, really nice moments while you're watching it where you realize, wow, that was really well done. You know, look at that pinwheel. It looks so three-dimensional. Look at that roasted corn. You know, it looks so realistic. So there's lots of moments where you're really enjoying the way it was rendered and drawn. Character herself, like you said, Mike, she's very relatable, because who doesn't wonder when they're going to find out what their gift is, especially as a young person? And the pressure of being the only one in your family who has not been blessed with some sort of, you know, special thing that you can do, you know, supersonic hearing, or, you know, unbelievable strength, or, you know, what have you, you know, no matter what it is, this idea that you've somehow been, you're not special, you don't have what everybody else has. I think it's something almost everybody can relate to feeling at some point in their lives. So that works all the way across the board. And her saying things like, am I too late for a miracle? And when magic doesn't work, you know, what are you supposed to do? If that's what the underpinnings of your whole world is, what happens when it fails? It does a great job of dealing with these ideas. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, it absolutely does deal with those ideas. And underscoring what you're saying, the fact that the storyline itself, the setting, when we mentioned a family in Colombia, the influence of Gabriel Garcia Marquez type magical realism, we're getting into Latin American culture here. And this is an area where we should talk, you know, in terms of representation. In animated films now, the fact that you will have principal characters of color, if you will, but in this case, like an entire family, an entire story that is representing that and doing a nice job of it. And on a technical level, the nice job of it, the color, the fluidity, the animation, things Marie and I were talking about, the creative team here, directors, co-directors, and writers and so on, had worked on Zootopia and Moana. So they've worked on films that received Academy Awards and Academy Award nominations. So at that level, it scores certainly, as I say, in terms of thematically dealing with this Latin American family and how that dovetails with that magical realism that we think of most often in Latin American fiction, but why not in filmmaking? And we find it there sometimes as well. And further underscoring that sense of, you know, presenting an ethnicity that has not been represented as often as it should be historically in animated films, as well as Hollywood film history in general. The fact that several of the songs in the film are by none other than Lin-Manuel Miranda. And the fact that, you know, you have someone here who's working with Latin pop tunes, and he's actually doing what I refer to, or what is referred to, as genre hopping. The musical score here is just really so eclectic. You have some things that are out and out like Latin pop. You have some other things that are like just sort of like light classical, what have you. Some more standard Hollywood scoring, if you will. And that's actually part of the fluidity of the film, is that it really goes pretty smoothly, I think, from one musical style to another. So even though oftentimes I object to animated films that I think are too busy, you know, we're all suffering from attention deficit disorders or something. You know what I'm getting at? It's just like it just bounces around relentlessly and you get a headache. Here, it does move fast. It bounces around. There's a lot, but it's in the service of a viable story. So it doesn't just seem arbitrary in terms of the magical effects. No, it all stays wedded to that story about a family with magical powers, except for the one girl. And so on all those levels, as I say, you know, again, I'm not saying this is like a great film, but I'm saying it's a really very enjoyable film. And that's enough sometimes to be an enjoyable film.
You know, I have to wonder if there's any project that Lin-Manuel Miranda was not involved in this past year. It seems like he has been part of several things I've watched, including, and I can't think of what the name of it is, but there was another animated feature that came out featuring his music in this past year. The name escapes me at the moment. Now, one thing I did think was an allusion was one of the siblings of the main character has the power to, you know, manipulate objects. And there is a stairs that are sort of created while you're walking up them, very much borrowed from Harry Potter. I don't know if that was deliberate or not. But in terms of similarities to Coco, you know, both of these movies have this misunderstood dark sheep character who is eventually sort of accepted back into the family, along with this idea of, you know, you have nothing to prove. It's nice to have magical powers or whatever, but, you know, your intrinsic worth is about something else. So, you know, to your point, Mike, it's a great movie to take your family to go see. It's got a lot of nice moments, certainly wonderful to look at. And I will say, if you're thinking of watching it, go see it in the theater, because you won't get the overwhelming sense of color coming at you on a small screen. I mean, I thought that was one of the pleasures of seeing it in the theater. It was just the burst of color.
Yeah, I agree with you, Marie, because watching it in a theater, there actually were a lot of young families there at the screening I attended, and they were really pulled into the film. You can tell that. I mean, you know, the kids weren't as restless as they might ordinarily be. People were really kind of fixed on the story. And it's nice to have that sort of immersive effect, that those bursts of color are on a big screen. This is a film where I think it does make a difference. You're absolutely right.
Now, in terms of best animated feature, you know, that's always one of the things I'm looking for the Academy Awards, you know, whatever's released that's animated, you know, I always try to take a look and see what I think will be the winner. This seems like the front runner.
I think this is probably the front runner, and they know that. I mean, it's released in December. It's Oscar bait, and we're going for the Oscar bait. But, you know, even if it had been released earlier in the year, it's certainly been that list. But, you know, the fact that it's released just, you know, in the final weeks of the year, that makes a big difference because people have fresh memories of it. And I think, Marie, you're right, that certainly it will get a nomination and, yeah, probably would qualify as a front runner or the front runner.
Any other thing you want to say about this film before we move on to our documentary features?
Marie, only to reiterate the fact that because it involves this very Latin American theme material, musically, thematically, with the storyline and so on, and with the characters, their stories, again, I would like to see us reach the point where it would not be worth noting. By that, I simply mean where it would just be like the norm, right? You know, people come in all shapes and sizes and colors, and films will represent that, and bam, case closed, let's move on to talk about other things in the film. But in our present moment, and the present moment seems to last for decades, it is still notable and worth noting that this is an animated feature that, by way of representation, brings to the screen characters and storylines that traditionally have been not entirely overlooked, but often overlooked by mainstream Hollywood films. What do you think to that point? Because I think it is still kind of notable for that.
Yeah, and I agree. I actually think it would be interesting to watch this back to back with Coco. I wonder if the color would just sort of recede at that point where you just take it for granted and then maybe be able to appreciate the cultural things that come out in both of these movies, which I agree, don't get enough play. But moving on to our second topic, and again, with the Academy Awards, I'm always curious to see what will be nominated for Best Documentary Feature, particularly because it's usually not things that I have seen during the year in the theaters. It's this scramble once things are announced to try to dig up all these esoteric documentaries, watch them, and you know, see which one wins. But I think we have some contenders here, at least the one I'm going to talk about. I'm very jealous that you've gotten to see the Julia documentary because I'm a big fan of Julia Child. And in fact, in March, when we have the Salon on campus, I will be playing Julia Child. So I'm very interested in seeing this movie. I've read so much backstory to prepare for the role. But it was only playing at the Charles. It did not come to my local theaters. So Mike, tell me what I missed in the documentary, Julia.
Well, Marie, first of all, to pick up on your point that coming up in early next year, you will be Julia Child. You are playing her. And many people will have fond recollections, not just of Julia Child, this you know, cultural icon, and not just in terms of cooking, but just American culture. But the fact that many people also have fond memories of a movie from 2009, and this is a fictional film, a feature film, Julie and Julia, in which, you know, Meryl Streep, you know, played Julia Child, of course, and her husband, Paul, was played by Stanley Tucci. Marie, you have one great advantage over Meryl Streep. This is where you're going to be more convincing than Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep is only 5'6". Julia Child was around 6'1", 6'2". You are taller than Meryl Streep. And for that reason, you will give a better performance. And so speaking of award recognition, you may well get it for your role in the Literary Salon. But that film in 2009, again, was a fictionalized account, but the storyline is so true in the sense that, you know, in the post-war years, Julia Child, you know, rethinks American cooking. She gets us away from jello molds and Spam and all that. And for her, the joys of traditional French cooking. And to show that anyone can do it. And if there are accidents in the kitchen, and there's some great ones in her TV shows, you just laugh and you keep going, right? There's this indomitable spirit. You say, oops, you know, it fell on the floor. Oh, well, let's brush it off and put it back in the pot. You know, that kind of a thing. And so even though, you know, Julie and Julia is a somewhat different experience in that it has parallel stories. It's Julia Child, you know, in terms of her life story with the Meryl Streep character. And then also there's a second parallel story, of course, with a much younger character who's decided to make like all 520 some recipes in the joy of French cooking. I mean, she's going to do all that. Anyway, I don't want to get bogged down with that version from 2009, but simply to say it's a touchstone. It's the point of entry for a lot of people. They've seen a movie about Julia Child before, a feature film. Now, to our present point, Julia, the film we're talking about, is a straightforward documentary. And, you know, it is, on the one hand, it's a very conventional film in terms of using archival footage, in terms of talking head interviews. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just sort of a straight ahead, here's the life and so on. And it works well enough at that level. On the other hand, why it works really well is just simply Julia Child herself. I mean, it is a fascinating life story. And what I did find really, really interesting about this documentary film about Julia Child is how well it tracks the long and very happy marriage. And this is something really worth noting, that long and very happy marriage between Julia Child and her husband. Again, because you have so much archival footage, to see the two of them together, to see what is such a genuine marriage, just a meeting of the minds and melding of the personalities. And then you realize the extent to which she had that backdrop, that anchor, whatever metaphors you want to use, that, you know, she did face real issues of, you know, could she, first of all, here's the first issue, or one of the first issues, when they were living in France just after World War II, you know, she gets this interest in the cuisine. She was the only woman in her cooking class. You can imagine how snooty some of the male French chefs must have been and her fellow students. She had to like charge on, keep going, work through that. Likewise, when she eventually became a public television host, she had to like really assert herself and prove herself. And there are a lot of strong examples in her life where she had obstacles like that. But she was not going to let anything stop her. She really, you know, was so assertive that way, and in an endearing way. I mean, not in a way that seemed bossy or standoffish. No, she just was a presence on camera. That comes across really well in this film. So again, it's the marriage, I think, to Paul. It's that marriage that really just gave her that backdrop, that comfort, that security. She's in a stable domestic life there. And as she goes into a professional life, you know, how she's able to really establish herself. So I keep using the word marriage here in terms of, you know, the marriage to that husband, but also the marriage of, you know, a host on TV really, really winning over an audience. People really took to her in the way they didn't take to some of the other, you know, celebrity chefs, not to the same extent. She really established herself very strongly. So yeah, I like this documentary because it does really capture that personality and that sense of marriage, both in her personal life and then professionally, in terms of how she brought all these things together and made it work, had a good long run on public television.
Now, if you haven't seen Julia, because, you know, you're not Mike and you don't live near the Charles and haven't seen it, hasn't come here yet, I really recommend seeing Julie and Julia for some of the things that Mike has just pointed out. I would say that Paul and Julia Child were like the original power couple, because, you know, they really enhanced each other's careers. And there's several wonderful moments in Julie and Julia. One is what you were talking about, Mike, where, you know, she habitually messed things up in the kitchen, dropped things on the floor, and then she'd pick it back up like it was nothing and say, "Who's to see?" But what the Julie and Julia really gets across very well, this is when I really took a really hard look at Stanley Tucci as an actor. He just plays Paul Child too. Perfection. You know, you really get the sense that he really got her, that he was 100% behind her career, not begrudging in the slightest, did not think she was at all inadequate to the task. And there's a wonderful moment when she has had a setback and she thinks, you know, maybe all is lost. And he's charging on ahead with, you know, you should be on television. And she, of course, laughs because she's, you know, like you said, 6'1" and kind of ungainly and, you know, not what you would think central casting would put out there as the face of, you know, American cooking or however you want to put it. And she looks at him incredulously, "I can't be on television." And when you're watching this, of course, you're thinking, yeah, you can. You actually are going to do that and be really good at it. And when you watch that scene, though, you see she doesn't believe it, but he totally does. Now, of course, that who knows where they made that up from. It could maybe never even happen, but it certainly gets across this idea of how involved with each other's careers and how completely on each other's side they were. Just such a delightful movie. I hope the documentary is at least as good.
Well, Marie, to your one point there, the greatest virtue of the Julie and Julia is at the level of acting, the creative marriage, if I can call it that, of Meryl Streep and Stanley Tucci. they work together beautifully. And Tucci just perfectly captures that character. I had mixed feelings about it as a film, but boy, that works so, so well in it. My final observation about Julia Child, both in the fictional film and in the documentary and in her life, is the fact that I love that on various occasions in interviews, you know, people would say, well, you know, gee, some of the things you're making, some of the dishes, a lot of cholesterol, a lot of this and that, you know, is it good? Is it healthy? I loved when she would always respond, do not be afraid of good food. And she would point out that, you know, she'd had a good long life using all of that butter and all that cream. And you know what? She enjoyed it. So it's possible to enjoy life and to eat well and to have a good long life. And yes, a long, happy marriage.
You know, the final point that I'll make about Julia Child before we move on to the movie I want to talk about is that it's easy to forget now that we actually have entire channels devoted to cooking shows. A couple of them, you know, there's HGTV and there's the Cooking Channel and there's just all kinds of ways. Recipe TV. You can watch people cooking on TV all day long if you want to. But back when she did it, no one was doing that. There was nobody doing a cooking show. And certainly nobody was going to show you how to make French food or, you know, what to do with a beef tenderloin. So she really was groundbreaking in a way that's actually kind of hard to grasp because it's just so ubiquitous now. But we owe it all to Julia. So the movie I want to talk about, the documentary, is called The Most Reluctant Convert, which is a backstory about C.S. Lewis, who most people know from the Narnia stories, which have sold I don't know how many billions of copies worldwide. And of course, he also did a short-lived three-book science fiction set and, of course, all the Christian apologetics. And what I've always liked about C.S. Lewis, and I'm a huge, huge fan of C.S. Lewis, is that he's an intellectual, but also witty. And the way they do this particular documentary is right from the play, same exact material, and I think actually probably unfolds precisely the same way, except, you know, you do get to get out of the stage environment. And he takes you with him as he goes back in time and, you know, looks at certain scenes from, you know, when he was growing up. And what makes this work so delightfully is that the actor playing C.S. Lewis is a wonderful actor. And he gives you the sense that you are walking around with C.S. Lewis himself, because he does things from time to time, like he walks into a pub, greets the guy behind the bar because he knows him, orders the usual, and then looks at the camera and asks you if you want one too. Then he takes two glasses of beer with him to a little table where you sit down and he looks right at you as if he's talking to you in this little pub, you know, somewhere near Oxford. And it's very effective. It really makes you feel like you've been taken into his inner circle. And then you get to see scenes from his childhood, scenes from Oxford, time where as a young man in college, he spent with J.R.R. Tolkien, who was a classmate, you know, at university. All of these really, really wonderful moments. And the script itself is borrowing heavily from his actual work. So the very witty things that he's saying, these are C.S. Lewis's actual words. Some of it's coming from his book, Surprised by Joy. But his attitude is just so engaging. And of course, the things he has to say are so well said. Now, I saw this in the theater. I was the only person in there. And it had a very short run. It came and went. But I did find, while looking up information about it, if you go to cslewismovie.com, you can watch this streaming on your own computer for $19.99, which of course is, that's not cheap. But, you know, if you think about it, that's almost what it costs for two people to buy tickets to go see it in the theater. And then you get to watch it over and over for 3 days. So I did enjoy watching it a couple of times. I knew as soon as I saw it in the theater that my husband would love it. So we watched it and, you know, I liked it just as much the second time. He liked all the things about it that I did. So highly, highly recommend this C.S. Lewis documentary. I think it's got a real chance for best documentary at the Oscars. What I want to ask you, Mike, is what it did make me think of, obviously, is Shadowlands, the movie where Anthony Hopkins plays C.S. Lewis. And of course, the various movies that have been made out of three of C.S. Lewis's Narnia books, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Mike, do you have anything you want to say about Shadowlands or those movies made out of his books?
Well, Marie, I'll just pick up on your one observation in terms of, you know, is it Oscar worthy? You know, evidently it is. But This is where I wonder, it's had relatively limited visibility, if you will. It was a very brief theatrical run. It is available. I don't think it's that widely known, you know, as films go. I think what you're doing right now is that kind of important missionary work of letting people know about it, you know, selling it, if you will. So I'm all with you on that there. But I'm just thinking that, you know, not that many people will have seen it or known of it. So that could limit the chances of getting an Oscar nomination or certainly of winning it. But anyway, to your other essential point, Lewis is so popular across various platforms, as they would say, you know, people reading his books or films based on them and so on, that works in its favor. So I'll turn it back to you with that observation that people who like him tend to really love him, right? And so that's like a kind of built-in literary fan club. And that certainly would help in terms of Academy Award voters that he's thought of well, as they say. So yeah, I think it probably would merit attention there. I was really intrigued by your point that, you know, when you have an actor portraying it, that's a kind of a dicey strategy sometimes. But here, you know, as you say, if it works, it works. You know, it might not work in other occasions, other actors. But back to your point there, you seem to feel like, you know, as you're watching, you really feel like you're watching C.S. Lewis.
Not only that, but you really get the sense of, you know, coming back to the title, The Most Reluctant Convert. I had just assumed from the things I had read by C.S. Lewis that he, you know, grew up in the faith and this was just part of who he was always. And in fact, he was a devout atheist and, you know, not at all interested in coming around or being convinced and had, you know, a really tough way to go growing up. His mother died when he was very young. And he even describes to you as, you know, you're walking around discussing things as if you and C.S. Lewis are now good friends. You know, he talks about the bargains that he tried to make with God at the time when his mother was dying and, you know, the things that he swore he would do if things went his way and his prayers, as he thought, you know, went unanswered. He struggles with his faith, which I think is a surprise, which is why I think anybody interested in his works would find this fascinating, because he approaches it like a very intellectual man that he was. You don't always get that point of view. I also think this makes a great companion piece with Shadowlands, because Shadowlands shows you him as an older man, you know, finding love with a woman named Joy, hence the name of the book, Surprised by Joy. This is it's a side of C.S. Lewis you might not have even known existed. I didn't. And when you get to have him showing you around and, you know, going to see Oxford back in the day and all those moments, it's just really, really nice to spend time with him. You really get the sense that, you know, what a fully rounded human being that, you know, you would have liked to have met, just like you kind of always suspected. But that brings us to the end of this episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com and also under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.